On September 21st, 14-year-old Bobby Reyes suffered a severe asthma attack and went into cardiac arrest. He was taken to the University of Michigan hospitals. On October 15th, he was taken off life support and died. What happened in between those two dates was a collision of policies, the law, and ethics. And on our Justice with Honor today, from Concordia University, Ann Arbor, Dan Klebis, who heads up the Justice and Public Policy Program, has brought in a special guest, and it is the attorney for the Reyes family, Bill Amadeo. And he is with McManus and Amadeo here in Ann Arbor. Gentlemen, great to have you on to talk about a very difficult issue.
Thank you for having me.
This has been a very polarizing time on both sides of this issue, hasn't it?
No question about it.
Dan, from your perspective, with the students you teach at Concordia University, these real-world cases that you bring into the classroom are so illuminating for your students.
Well, not only that, but the title of our program is Justice and Public Policy. So we do get into public policy, which this does cover. Being a Christian campus, we also get into the biblical end of the right to life and such. So this kind of covers the entire spectrum. And the one question that I have and that I would ask everybody to keep in mind right now is, what if this happened to you?
What would you want to be done?
Yeah.
And I think there are obviously differing views on this. Tell me first, though, about Bobby. Who was he, Bill?
He was a sweet 14-year-old kid, very religious child, a history buff, somebody that everybody loved. I can't tell you how many people on Facebook, parents, teachers, religious sect, have contacted me saying how much Bobby enlightened our world. It's a completely tragic situation because, of course, anytime a 14-year-old dies, it's tragic, but there was something special about this child. And everybody that he came across, he made their world better.
Who are his parents?
Sarah Jones and Jose Reyes, close friends of mine. I've gotten very close with them the last few weeks, obviously. And it goes without saying they're devastated about everything.
How many children do they have?
They have five total.
Including a twin.
Including a twin, yeah.
A boy?
A boy twin, yeah. And you can imagine as a twin, of course, all the siblings are going to be heartbroken, but to see your twin there in that hospital, what a heart-wrenching scenario.
Had he ever had any asthma attack like this before?
From what I understand, maybe a minor one here or there, but his mom didn't know it was happening. And we learned that the third week of September is the worst case for asthma attacks. The kid was playing video games in his house. He starts having a hard time breathing. His mom panicked, called 911, rushed him to the fire station.
Which was down the street?
Down the street, like less than a block away. They airlifted him to Mott, and the rest is history, unfortunately.
When he arrived at Mott, what was the situation like? What have you been told about that?
I've been told that they deemed him brain dead right away. The feeling was that he lost air for a substantial amount of time. They didn't feel there was much hope. At that point, they had to do a second test. That's what Michigan law says to determine if one is brain dead.
What was the first test, though?
The first test was a standard test to see if he had his faculties, so on and so forth. And the initial doctor said he was deemed brain dead.
Is that where they look at the eyes? Is a visual
blood
type?
Pressure, yeah.
Okay.
All that. And they use what their so-called expertise is to make that determination.
So was he not put on life support immediately?
From what I understand, it was pretty quick. I don't know if it was immediate. They did whatever test they did. I wasn't involved at that point. Mm-hmm. But he was on life support in a fairly quick fashion.
This so-called second test that everyone's been talking about, yeah, where some people say don't let them do a second test because at that point, if it shows that someone is brain dead, that's it. There's no going back from that.
That's correct.
That point. What is that test?
The second test is more like a reaffirmation of the first test. They run the same situation, same scenarios, and if nothing has changed, like the blood pressure hasn't gone up, the blood sugar hasn't changed, that confirms what their initial conclusion was.
But isn't the second test where they actually take the life support out to see?
If he's deemed to still be brain dead, then they pull the life support off. So they actually do a second test before they take the life support off.
And if they take it out and it shows that he is?
He has a chance? Yeah, then they'll do whatever procedures they need to keep the child alive. U of M rushed to do this second test because they felt he was brain dead from the get-go. And our whole feeling was we didn't want them doing a second test until we got other opinions. And people across the country, doctors across the country, contacted me basically saying that the first test was not valid.
Why?
They felt there's things U of M did not look at initially, and I'm not a medical doctor, but I could tell you three different doctors across the country came to me and said, we want to do a second test ourselves. We feel he has a better chance if we perform our test. I'm not an expert on what they would have done versus what U of M would have done, but there were medical professionals, and I explained this to the court, that believed Bobby may have had a second chance at life, and they wanted to perform their test. U of M was not having it.
Hospitals have ethics.
Sure.
They have a procedure that they have to follow.
Correct.
In these kinds of cases.
Yeah.
And what to do. What role does the family play in that legally?
You know, and this is one of the reasons we're talking about a change in the law. Initially, the family has constitutional protection. But in Michigan, once that child's deemed brain dead off the first test, the parents' rights kind of disappear. People are comparing Bobby's case to the Titus Cromer case at Beaumont. But let me be clear with that. They're very different tests. Titus, who we're praying for, obviously, is deemed to have brain damage. Bobby was deemed to be brain dead. There's a fine line right there. Brain damage means there is a greater chance of recovery. Brain dead basically means the game's over.
And yet Titus is in the same situation that Bobby was?
Well, he's on life support right now, from what I understand. But he's at Beaumont. And Beaumont, as opposed to U of M, is like night and day. U of M's a state actor. Beaumont is more of a private sector situation. So with the Beaumont case, you can file in circuit court, have an emergency hearing. One of the problems, which I'm sure we'll talk about, was when you're suing the University of Michigan, you have to file in the court of claims on a situation like this. And that procedural error caused a lot of chaos.
There was an attorney before you,
yes,
who the Reyes family had engaged.
Correct.
A firm out of Southfield.
Mm-hmm.
And they initially filed in the wrong court. Yeah. They filed in circuit court?
They filed in circuit court. Actually, let me take you through that. They filed in circuit court, and then they amended their complaint in circuit court.
Amended it to what?
Basically, it was still a TRO, a temporary restraining order, stopping U of M from doing the second test and pulling Bobby off life support. But they actually filed incorrectly twice. At the time, Judge Schwartz, who was our judge, was in a double murder trial, and we were trying to find a judge to sign the orders. I was just there for support at that point. I wasn't the lawyer of record at that time. They did, the circuit court in Washington did eventually sign the order, but it kind of slipped through the cracks. So U of M was going to move for a dismissal.
You're telling me the court made a mistake? The court signed something they shouldn't have, signed off on this.
Basically, the attorney filed in the wrong court.
Right.
And then the court, without reviewing it, because it's an emergency motion, just signed off on it. So the court actually made a mistake by signing off on it.
Given that, wouldn't that allow jurisdiction back in that court?
Well, here's the situation there. When that occurs, and it's not a frequent thing, it's standard that you get an emergency stay to file in the correct court.
Did you?
I tried, and I called U of M as a courtesy. I had to call the other side and say, listen, there's a mistake here procedurally. And when I called U of M, they basically said, well, if you're filing in the correct court, we're going to move for a dismissal of the TRO that's in place right now. Well, if they moved for the dismissal at that juncture and then they did the rush job that they did, Bobby may have been dead long before this happened.
I want to make sure we understand this. So you're saying that when you contacted the University of Michigan, mm-hmm, to let them know you were going to go for this emergency stay.
Yeah.
They said, well, if you're going to end up filing in the correct court, which would have been the
Court of Claims.
Court of Claims up in Lansing.
Correct.
Because it's a University of Michigan. It's a state.
State actor.
State actor.
Correct.
State hospital. That's why it had to go in Court of Claims, not the Washtenaw County Circuit Court.
Correct.
If you had gone to do that, that would have given them
the opportunity to dismiss what was filed in circuit court And then they could have pulled him off life support.
If it had been dismissed and it was in between courts,
right,
they could have taken that
action. There was no guarantee the Court of Claims was going to grant the TRO.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when we tried to file in the Court of Claims after the circuit court dismissed the case, the Court of Claims refused to accept our filing. So there's a chance they never would have accepted the TRO to begin
with. What determines if the Court of Claims is going to accept a filing, and what grounds did they not accept it? Because you made the rush up to Lansing.
Yeah, we did.
You were trying to get this done before he was taken off life support.
Well, that's funny, because when we contacted the Court of Claims, initially we asked if we could do an electronic filing, which is standard in Michigan. They refused. We rushed up there, and they argued with us for an hour about how we can't accept this, blah, blah, blah.
What were their reasons?
They didn't really give us any reasons. They just didn't think, other than it may not be a valid claim. As of today, the judge still has not signed the order. U of M contacted me last night saying they want to dismiss the case because it's moot. And sadly, it is moot at this point.
Why is it still active?
Because the judge never signed the order, mm-hmm, and then Bobby passed away, it stayed in limbo for a minute. The Court of Claims contacted me and said, will you dismiss this? And I said, I will dismiss this without prejudice, because a dismissal without prejudice would still preserve the right for the family to seek other litigation, which I wouldn't be involved in. But
what did they say when you said that? That you would
dismiss without prejudice?
Yes.
Well, they told me I could mail it in or fax it in. And I said to them, ironically, she wouldn't let me fax it in when I was trying to save the kid's life. And then she basically hung up on me. And then U of M contacted me last night saying they're filing a motion that the issue is moot.
What is the rule on faxing this kind of thing up to a Court of Claims?
More and more courts in Michigan are allowing electronic filing. There's no set rule in the Michigan court rules. It's basically the court's preference. But it's pretty standard in an emergency situation. You could fax or email something over. In this case, they would not allow it. So we did rush over there, but there's
Why would they not allow it? What was their premise?
I kept asking them, why aren't you allowing this? This child's life is on the line. And they kept saying to me, well, we have our own procedures here.
And yet when they said that the case was still open after his death, asking you to dismiss this,
I could mail it in at that
You
point.
Could mail it, or you could fax it in at that time.
Exactly. So sounds like a contradiction. Why can we fax in a dismissal, but we can't fax in a motion?
When have you done anything with that yet then?
I have not. I talked to the U of M lawyer last night, and he said to me how he's filed this motion for dismissal. And I said to him, look, we could stipulate to a dismissal at this point. The issue's moot. I'll stipulate to a dismissal without prejudice, allow the family to do whatever they feel they need to do in this scenario. But I don't know if we need another court hearing to put the family through this. They haven't responded to me as of yet.
Both sides have to agree to the dismissal?
Yeah.
So you couldn't just dismiss. They couldn't just.
No, it has to be a mutual situation. And it's pretty standard that both sides would agree to a dismissal. The flip side of that, though, Lucianne, is it's pretty standard for both sides to agree to a stay, which U of M never agreed to. It's unheard of that when a situation like this occurs, that both sides would not work as a team to get the case in the right court. I didn't file in the wrong court. I called U of M asking for mercy to work with me to file in the correct court, and they were not having it.
Again, I want to make sure listeners understand this. We understand that the first attorney that the family had engaged made this mistake, filed in the wrong court.
Sure.
You happen to be up at court, and you find out this is going on from a mutual person.
Yeah. At that point, the other lawyer was still their attorney of record. I went there to help them navigate the court system.
Because they weren't necessarily familiar with the Washtenaw County courts.
I know the judges there, and I took mm-hmm. them back to chambers, etc. But I was basically there just for support of the family. When I left court that day, I still was not the attorney of record. About 2 days later, I stayed in touch with Sarah and Jose, and they explained to me that the other lawyer was not getting back to them. They didn't know what was going on. I formally took over at that point, and I reached out to U of M right away. They hired outside counsel. And the first conversation I had with outside counsel after hours was, well, this is a bad filing. We're moving to dismiss. And the first thing I said to him was, I'm going to file in the correct court. Grant me a stay. He wouldn't do that. We negotiated for a few minutes. He finally gave us like an additional 3 days before the order would be terminated. But if I had filed prior to that, it would have been dismissed. What I was hoping would happen in that 3 days was we were going to find Bobby in another hospital. One of the things that people don't understand, in addition to the procedural error, I was trying to buy the child time because we had so many leads of hospitals that were going to take him. Before the order expired on that Friday, Arizona came through, which I believe was Wednesday afternoon, Allegiant Healthcare, and they said, we're taking him. From that moment, our whole course of action went about, okay, can I find some way to airlift this child? Because I have some people in the aviation world. What's it going to cost to move the family there, the GoFund situation? It was almost like it became now, can I help them with fundraising? Can I have contacts across the country? We thought we had the issue solved.
You were focused on doing that.
Right.
Because you thought this hospital was going to take him.
And that's what they told
me. And that was the whole focus at that point.
That was the whole focus.
You were eating up time
right.
doing that.
Exactly. And then the next day, which was Thursday, they reneged on their offer. And I contacted U of M and I said, listen, I know we have this order that goes till Friday, but we didn't expect Arizona to do what they just did. Can I have more time? And their initial reaction was no. I contacted the court, the circuit court, and they gave us until Tuesday to try to find more time and get a hearing at that point. We were finding hospitals doing this and doing that. During the weekend, I contacted the lawyers from U of M. We had about, I'm going to say 80 to 100 emails and phone calls going back and forth. It was about 80 hours at least of work, just nonstop negotiating. And what I wanted to do at that juncture was, if you could give me till the following Thursday, I felt I had a few solid leads, we could get Bobby a second hospital. So can you grant me until Thursday? And if you grant me until that Thursday, we'll waive any jurisdictional issues and call it a day. U of M said no. They wouldn't grant us till extra 2 days.
This is what I don't understand. In my mind, why not err on the side of life? What was there that prevented? Was there something in the ethical policies that they have that wouldn't have allowed them to do that, do you think?
U of M sent me emails explaining their ethical policy and how they feel it's wrong to keep this child who they deem brain dead alive.
Mm-hmm.
My counter to that was, I understand your position, but there is a flip side to this argument. And the flip side is, I have a number of physicians who feel Bobby has a chance at life. If you grant us 48 more hours, there's a chance I could try to play a role in saving this child. They said, we have our policies in place and our policies are effective. And it just became a tug of war.
Do you think some of those policies, though, are financially driven? For example, in this case, and I don't know the financials to the case, but certainly a question. Do you think that U of M's decision was based partially on financial responsibility?
You know, initially, I did not believe that. I was hoping they were working above board. But as you learn more and more, I do think finances played a role in this. We have a family who's on the lower end of socioeconomics, who I believe was on Medicaid. And I said this to both you guys off the record, and I'll say it on the record. I truly believe if it was a grandchild of a trustee or somebody at U of M, they would still be fighting to find a place. This was a poor kid. Family didn't have money. Economics, in my opinion, played a role in the final decision.
I'm not sure what the difference would have been to the university, though, because
If he
was either going to be going to another hospital or they were going to be pulling life support. Either way, he wasn't going to be there.
I seem to think every day that Bobby was there cost the University of Michigan money. And I seem to think if it was somebody who was more lucrative, they might have been willing to give more time.
The University of Michigan, Michigan Medicine, their statement where they extended the condolences to the family – Talking about the second brain death examination was conducted late this morning, and Bobby was pronounced dead. Mechanical ventilation was discontinued after the family gathered in the patient's room. The brain death examination showed Bobby had no detectable brain or brain stem function. Further testing, including an EEG and a cerebral blood flow study, detected no electrical activity and no blood flow to Bobby's brain. By law in Michigan, they write, an individual is dead who has sustained either irreversible cessation of circulatory or respiratory functions or irreversible cessation of all function of the entire brain, including the brainstem. Continuing medical interventions was inappropriate after Bobby had suffered brain death and violates the professional integrity of Michigan medicine's clinicians.
That's their position. What they're leaving out there is, as we were trying to file at the Court of Claims, we contacted Bobby Schindler, who's head of the Terry Schiavo Foundation, and Bobby was there with the family, and Bobby told the doctors that something's being filed as we speak. Please give this child more time. And what their reaction to that was, they threatened to have Bobby Schindler arrested. University of Michigan also doesn't tell you how the priest was in there giving last rites, and they felt that he was taking too long, and they kind of rushed that situation. They were very annoyed that we were still trying to fight after the circuit court dismissed the case. And
did the parents have to sign giving permission for the ventilator to be taken off?
Based on law, no, unfortunately.
Why?
The current statute in Michigan basically says that once the child is deemed brain dead, even if the family wants to keep fighting, they're in an uphill battle.
Is that the law in other states?
No. No. There's, every state has a different version of this law. Like, I could tell you in New Jersey, where I grew up, Bobby would have been given more of an opportunity. I could tell you making it in a place like Texas, which I'm not great with Texas law, but he may not have been given as much of an opportunity as he had. Every state has a different version of this law.
And is it after the second test happens that the parents lose the rights?
Technically, the parents lose the rights after the first test. And the reason why the Beaumont case is so different is because Titus Cromer is deemed to have brain damage as opposed to actually being deemed brain dead.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very significant difference, Lucianne.
Mm-hmm.
So according to the medical professionals, Titus is in a better situation than Bobby was in.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly hope and pray Titus makes it, but his situation gives you more teeth to fight.
Why did other doctors who contacted you, or you contacted them, why did they think that Bobby Reyes had a chance if he was brain dead?
Yeah. Dr. Bonifiglia was the main one.
Who's a Michigan medical school
graduate. And licensed in Michigan. He lives in Pittsburgh now. He's licensed in Michigan. And he said that there were other tests that could have been performed that he would have testified to that might have showed that Bobby was not brain dead.
Are you saying, and let's set this case aside, but are you saying that the jury's out on this whole science of being brain dead?
I think so.
There's disagreement in the medical world about being brain dead?
Sure. And a lot of the, if you want to call it the norm, are going to say to anybody that challenges them is not using the proper science. I'm not an expert in science, but I'm going to tell you, complete honesty, there are physicians across the country that feel one person's determination of brain dead is not the same as another. And the fact that three physicians came forward, and they didn't even say that Bobby was not brain dead. They wanted to perform tests that they felt the university did not perform. They wanted that opportunity. And I said this in chambers. And U of M says, well, Dr. Bonifiglio is not licensed in Michigan. And I said, actually, he is. Not only is he licensed in Michigan, he was head of your alumni association for the medical school. He's one of your own. And he's saying that there's a chance this child may not be brain dead. And the thing that's frustrating to me is, if there is a chance, how are we not going to give him that chance?
What would it have mattered? You know what I mean? What would it have mattered waiting to give that chance and to have a more definitive?
And if they gave us 48 more hours and we couldn't find anybody, you know, sadly, that might have been the end of it. But How can you not grant that? And Judge Schwartz, he's taken some slack. I'm going to tell you, he was torn up over this whole thing.
His hands were tied.
His hands were tied.
He couldn't do anything.
I will tell you something that happened in chambers, though, where he tried to help us. I asked the U of M lawyers, can you give me a stay to figure this thing out or give us 48 hours as we talked about? They said no. And at that point, I would need a consent of the other side to follow through. And they wouldn't give it. They felt enough time had passed.
But you're saying the judge had allowed that conversation to happen?
He did. And the judge turned to U of M and he said, well, how about a stay? Mr. Amadeo made that proffer. What's your position? And he said, no, we're not giving him the stay.
Bill Amadeo, attorney for the Reyes family, pro bono attorney.
Correct.
By the way, that first attorney, and I saw the bill, the first attorney who made the mistake, filed in the wrong court, sent a bill to the Reyes family.
They did.
For thousands.
It was, I think, $4,100, something like
$4,132.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more on Justice with Honor from Concordia University Ann Arbor. Dan Klebus, who heads up the Justice and Public Policy Department. And his special guest today is Bill Amadeo. On the Lucy Ann Lance Show, Ann Arbor's talk station, 1290 WLBY. For information about Concordia University Ann Arbor's Justice and Public Policy Program, visit cuaa.edu. This is the Lucy Ann Lance Show. Dan Klebus is the head of the Justice and Public Policy Department at Concordia. His special guest today is Bill Amadeo, who is with McManus and Amadeo in Ann Arbor. They're off of Packard Road. He is the attorney for the Reyes family, Bobby Reyes, the 14-year-old boy who was taken off life support. Family had been fighting that. People are calling for something called Bobby's Law, Bill. What would that be?
Bobby's Law would be legislation that would give parents more teeth in doing these tests. Maybe give the parent the right to do a second test. Perhaps get a second opinion, even while the child may not be transportable. In essence, Bobby's Law would change what happened here. I don't know if it would bring Bobby back, but it will give other children a chance to have their parents play more of a vital role in these decisions.
And are the parents going to be helping foster this?
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
We'll follow this. Thank you so much for sharing their side of the story this
morning.
Thank
you for your time.
Appreciate it. Dan, 2 seconds.
Thank you. And I'll provide an update on our open issues.
All right. Looking forward to that.